Buddha, Shuddha Sangha. So I was talking yesterday about the four wisdoms. I'm not going to go through them in detail. I'm going to talk a little bit about each one. But first I'm going to preface with something that Rinpoche Master used to say. It's not something I heard her say before 76, and so I don't remember her hearing her say it until, you know, 10 years or more after 76, and then she started saying it. It's really, I think, one of the really deep insights of her last years, really. And one of those really great teachings. She would say sometimes, you know, what we're trying to do in our training is become more like the eternal. And, you know, it takes a person to say that. They have to actually come to know what the eternal is like. And not just from other people's teaching, and not just from knowing how important meditation and the precepts are in your own life even, but really, you know, deep experience of the eternal over a long period of time. Not only deep experience, but deepening experience and broadening experience of the eternal. And this teaching came out of her later life when the degree of harmonization with the eternal had gone very, very far indeed. It's one of those simple sounding things that the way I've always kind of visualized this kind of teaching is actually there's no way to get a grip on it in a certain way. You either kind of get it or you don't. But there's no better way I know of to view the what's called the four wisdoms. Charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy. And just to say simply that these are ways of pointing out how important it is to be more like the eternal. And pointing out that our training is, the purpose of our training is to bring us into harmony with the eternal. The wisdom of charity, my own preferred rendering of whatever word that is, because this is what it really means, is generosity. And above all, as Reverend Master emphasized so strongly, as so many of us benefited so much from, is the generosity of the spirit, generosity of spirit. And what she really meant by that was that we, when we ourselves are wronged in some way, we really do not hang on to that. And we do not act upon our frustration or our anger or our sense of injustice. But we just absorb it and pass it on to the eternal. And we sit with the situation until we can act dispassionately and compassionately. When we do that, we are acting like the eternal, because there is no selfish reaction on the part of the eternal ever. The eternal always does the best for everyone. And it doesn't matter what you think of the eternal or whether you don't believe that there is the eternal or not. It doesn't matter. She used to say, you know, love really only knows how to love. It just loves and does the best it can at all times. It does not seek a reward for so doing. reward is in the doing. You know, and so, you know, remind me of Dogen's words. You know, we make offerings, although we ourselves get nothing whatsoever. There's no need to be concerned about how small the gift may be, so long as it brings true results. For even if it is a single phrase or verse of training, or verse of teaching, it may be a seed to bring forth good fruit both now and hereafter. Bring forth good fruit both now and hereafter. We don't have to worry about what we get out of it. Just do that which needs to be done. Do it with a pure heart and a generous heart. He says, we must not desire any reward, and we must always share everything we have with others. You know, by this, you know, especially, you know, if you're talking about this with monks, you know, we have to understand that all that we own, all that we have, all our gifts, whatever they may be, they belong to the eternal, not to us. And we're simply a custodian of something. And it's our responsibility to put it to the use of the eternal, to the eternal's use. Not to our own use, even including our own ideas of what is charitable and compassionate. So here's the other thing about this training to do that which the Eternal would do and to be like the Eternal. You can't do it without meditation. We need to meditate with our choices and allow all conditions to ripen while we're sitting with things. Allow our own opinions to quieten down, our own emotions to quieten down, and wait for everything to distill out to the point where it's time to act. This is why impulsive acts of charity are not charity in the sense of which I'm speaking. I suppose you could say it's better to be impulsively generous than impulsively hateful and mean-spirited. But it's much better not to be impulsive. To really do some serious asking and listening. This, you know, works its way out into some of the details and way in which a temple works. For example, you know, I've made it clear a number of times, I don't like people donating to the temple, donating things to the temple unless they've checked first. Why is that? They just don't run around with our own ideas about what's needed. Not that there's anything wrong with the impulse, but from the deeper point of view, it's wrong to be impulsive. Impulsiveness itself is a problem. In her commentary on the precepts, her master says, you know, do nothing whatsoever in a hurry. Don't act until you've distilled it down through meditation, until you can be as much in alignment with the eternal as you can be. Sometimes we simply run out of time, and then we've got to jump and hope for the best. Wherever possible, sit on it a bit. Ask, you know, what is it that is good to do? this won't make you less generous. It won't make you less spontaneous in any good sense. It'll just make you wiser and make what you do more effective. Note what he says here. This is important. There's no need to be concerned about how small the gift may be so long as it brings true results. That's the thing. When you get it right, it brings true results. Again, the word true is capitalized here, indicating something that's in alignment with the eternal. Not just our own idea of what's a true result. Since my retreat in 98-99, I've many times experienced the fact that I've had to do something that was very difficult to do, and that if I remember to ask, go to my altar and ask first, that even if the result of what I did was a mess, it was still better than if I hadn't done it. And things still went the right direction. Whereas, here's the killer on this, that even if I forgot to ask and everything seemed to work out, it still wouldn't work out as well as if I'd asked. I don't know if that makes sense. There's the working out that is our idea of things working out, and then there's working out that really truly does the best for everyone. Do we want to settle for our idea of what's best, or do we want to go to the eternal and find out what really is best, even if sometimes it's messier, at least initially? You don't need to be a deep thinker to do this. You do need to be a deep meditator. In the way the world thinks, and you see it, if you watch the news, you see it, believe me. When people do what the world recognizes as good deeds, they are praised. When people do what the world recognizes as evil deeds, they are blamed and despised. What Dogen says about tenderness or kind speech is to feel sorry for those who do not exhibit virtue and to praise those who do. And if we take this not only at the level of speech, but at the level of thought, what it's saying is there is no blame in the eternal. There is no judgment and condemnation in the eternal. There is no despising. And we have to be willing to live with the grief of existence, which is that there's a lot of karma being made, and a lot of it's pretty ugly. And at the same time, we have to not make it worse by ourselves joining in with the mud wrestling. Remember, you say, I know the mud exists. That doesn't mean I have to wallow in it. When we ourselves become vengeful, critical, negative, despising, judgmental, we just get in there and wallow in the mud with everyone else. We don't have to do that. You know, we have, one of the tools we have to help us not do that is the offering of merit. We can always offer merit for those who exhibit virtue and for those who do not. And after all, who needs the merit most? Those who do not. I remember One instance in particular where River Master basically stayed up all night because a man in Utah, I think he was being executed that night. It was on the news. And this was a person, some of you may remember the case, this is a person who actually had refused to appeal for clemency because he recognized that he'd done something, he'd like murdered someone. And he recognized what he'd done was wrong, and he just decided to eat the consequences. And they never explained what was going on in his head about that or what he said about that, that I can remember. But River Master stayed up all night and meditated with and offered merit. She said, the next day, she said what she had felt, what she had intuited on that, was that actually when he died, it was clean. Which means there must have been a really big sangha in there. They did execute him. You know, this religion we're practicing, it's not Christianity, and it's not what passes as Buddhism in the world. We simply do not have the luxury of looking down on people. And it comes up for me frequently that the biggest mistake you can make is to underestimate another person's spiritual potential. If you overestimate their potential, well, usually no great harm done. But if you underestimate it, especially the priest and a teacher, you really make a mistake. Don't underestimate people. And you know, one important step in underestimating is actually just speaking badly of them. We really need to work on ourselves so as not to dwell on negative thoughts and doubts about people. We work to accept people's humanity and understand that no matter how big the mess is, there is a Buddha nature in there. You know, our sins and our virtues mean nothing to the eternal. That love only loves and always does the best for everyone. When you really come to see the way in which karma works, the law of karma is just compassion, cosmic compassion. The best teaching there ever could be. We can just leave people to their karma and not worry about them. And when it's good to do so, offer merit. And always wish for their spiritual success rather than their downfall. The wisdom of benevolence, as Dogen says, is we exhibit that when we create wise ways of helping others. Well, right there, I mean, who is it that wisdom comes from? Not me. You know, what do I know? I don't even know how to help myself, much less someone else. So if there's going to be wisdom coming from somewhere, it better be coming from something deeper than my own opinions and my own experience. Well, not that my opinions and my experience are always irrelevant, but I need to be checking them. Check them with the eternal and check them, reasonably frequently, actually, with the Sangha. You know, I'm not much on dragging everyone together to have meetings, but I spend a lot of my time, talking with other seniors about situations and seeing what their take is on it. And I'm trusting them when I do that to meditate with it as I'm trying to do. I find quite frequently that what they have to say is helpful. Their point of view is helpful. And sometimes will really prevent me from taking a step that I recognize to have been a misstep if I had taken it. There is a refuge of the eternal, and there's a refuge of the Sangha. So when I listen to my own heart, meditation, well, I'm taking refuge in the Dharma at the deepest level, that which the eternal teaches. Another thing I'll say about the benevolence, I was talking about this with someone the other day, is that my experience of it is that when you really get it right, things line up so it does the best for everyone concerned, no matter how many parties are involved in the decision. It does the best for everyone. And if you're in a situation where someone's still being left out, to be helped by it, who's affected by the decision, it usually needs more time until everyone involved is helped. That working on it an important thing, sometimes it can mean sleepless nights, frankly, while you stew on it. It's one of the reasons why I don't have email here, because I'll often kind of write it out in a letter. Then because I don't do email, I have nowhere to send it by pushing a button. And it's frequently the case that I'll actually post the letter and then go retrieve it out of the post, because we don't take it every day. Sometimes I'll redo a letter, just I'll leave it on the computer and then redo it. Sometimes I'll just erase it after a while and then do another one. Sometimes it'll come down to where there's no letter at all. It'll be a phone call. And sometimes I end up doing nothing. But, you have to learn wise ways to help yourself slow down and digest. Let your meditation digest the situation. And when all the little ducks come up in a row and every party is helped by it, then that's one of the signs that it's ready to go. If there is that basic yes within you, yes, it can go. Yes, you can do it. There'd be a lot fewer people who flee from temples if they simply practice what I'm talking about before they pack up and flee. Sympathy. I love this. Sympathy is as the sea in that it never refuses water from whatever source it may come. All waters may gather and form only one sea. What's he talking about? The great ocean of the eternal. Within the great ocean of the eternal, there is no self and other. Sympathy, the wisdom of sympathy, as Dogen says, is identifying oneself with that which is not oneself. Well, how do you do that? You can try it by a psychological way, or you can try it by the deep way. I recommend it the deep way. Just go in meditation to that place where there is no difference. with some monks, this is carried so far that they get so empathic that life is just made harder, actually, for them. They so deeply experience the sufferings of others. If they so deeply experience the sufferings of others, when others get it right, they also deeply experience the joy of that. Another way of putting this is, don't willfully set yourself off from others by nurturing a doubting and critical mind and heart. Instead, always work to see the Buddha in others. River Master used to say when I was a young monk, she'd say a lot. She'd say, look with the eyes of a Buddha and you will see the heart of a Buddha. I bet you remember that. Look with the eyes of a Buddha and you will see the heart of a Buddha. When you do that, that's sympathy. The feeling of sympathy, by the way, that's a nice feeling. That's not the same as the wisdom of sympathy. You don't have to have the feeling of sympathy to manifest the wisdom of sympathy fully. I have to emphasize that. You can feel no sympathy for someone, and yet you can still act with utter sympathy. You can be very, very dispassionate and act with sympathy. This is about doing that which is truly good to do. It's not about any particular state of feeling. You don't have to be a person who feels enlightened to exhibit the four wisdoms. If we were to put it that way, we'd really have the cart before the horse. Because being human beings with karma, you know, we go around most of the time not feeling all that enlightened. People who do feel enlightened all the time, they belong in nut houses. That's called bipolar. That's one of the poles. These are wisdoms, they're not states of feeling. There's nothing wrong with the state of feeling when it's there, and it can help you. It can certainly help you at times do the right thing. But you can't base your actions on something as ephemeral as feeling, if you're going to really exhibit the wisdoms. Because so often feelings just don't line up the way you'd like them to. And that you've got to actually use your will. I'm trying to finish this today because I'm really burning out here, but hopefully in a good cause. The last section of Shishogi is putting the teachings into practice and showing gratitude. And what I would call it is following the eternal. Because that's what it's about. If you read that last section of Shishogi, one thing that always impressed me about it is that it's actually a lot like the first section of the Shishogi in a certain way. But neither one of them actually presumes any attainment. The first one is just about impermanence and suffering and the necessity of training ourselves because of impermanence and suffering. The last one's about gratitude and the necessity of training ourselves to exhibit gratitude. They're both about the necessity of training. I could never actually put that into words before, but that's always been my kind of intuitive impression of it. And in a way, it kind of puzzled me. Like that last section, there should be some really big kind of ta-da, you know, big reward time, you know, lotuses blooming, fireworks going off, you know, magnificent enlightenment. Instead, it's like, you know, put your shoes straight out of gratitude. You know? But there is no... The thing about the following of the eternal is the following of the eternal is the reward in itself completely. And there's simply no way of adequately communicating that, or no way of intellectually understanding it that I know of. It's just that it's with blood and bones I know it to be true. It's been proved to be true for me. The following of the eternal is the great reward. And it doesn't matter where it leads you. If it leads you into hell, that's fine. If it leads you to heaven, that's fine. If it leads you to anything in between, that's fine. It's better to be traveling through the hells following the eternal than to be in a heaven and just be kind of stuck there wasting your time until karma catches up with you and you end up in the hells. Of course, that doesn't mean that one wishes to go to the hells and be in states of deep misery. And it just happens to be true that there's nothing particularly easy about following the eternal. Things sometimes are very bright. Sometimes it's very bright. It doesn't stay that way for real long. Because there's always more to be done. More to be done in the conversion of our own karma. More to be done in that's called out of us by situations that naturally arise and needs that naturally arise in daily life. Therefore, River Master wrote in 1976, you know, whether I am well or sick, brightly alive or dying, hold fast to the Lord of the house. The external things aren't the things that matter. If you read this last section of Shogi with this in mind, you know, it really makes sense. If the truth had not spread throughout the entire world, it would have been impossible for us to have found it. Even should we have been willing to give our very lives for it, we should think deeply upon this. How fortunate have we been to be born now when it is possible to see the truth? This is just a gratitude for the fact that one finds this way. But what is this way that one is so grateful for? It's the way of the reharmonization with the unborn. The way to eternal life. This book was originally titled, when it first published, you know, Selling Water by the River, because Random House, that published it, didn't like the title Zen is Eternal Life. They thought it was too religious. So Rivermaster came up with that other kind of clever title. But it didn't mean she particularly liked it. And then when we started publishing ourselves, it got published as Zen is Eternal Life. The life of the eternal is my life and your life, our true life. Even though this body and mind is notoriously transitory. So here's one of the part of this I am going to read. And I hope everyone takes it to heart because it makes my life easier. Remember the Buddha's words. When you meet a Zen master who teaches the truth, do not consider his case, his appearance, shortcomings, or behavior. Bow before him out of respect for his great wisdom and do nothing whatsoever to worry him. And even if he's a big fool, still do the same thing. It's not your problem. This is all about, you read this, it's all about gratitude. It says, you need no further teachings than the above in order to show gratitude, and you must show it truly in the only real way in your daily life. Our daily life should be spent constantly in selfless activity with no waste of time whatsoever. And listen to this. Now, doesn't this sound just like the first part of the Shishogi? Listen to this. Should you live for 100 years just wasting your time, every day and month will be filled with sorrow. Should you drift as a slave of your senses for 100 years and yet live truly for only so much as a single day, you will in that one day not only live 100 years of life, but also save 100 years of your future life. The life of this one day today is absolutely vital life. Your body is deeply significant. Both your life and your body deserve love and respect, for it is by their agency that truth is practiced and the Buddha's power exhibited. The seat of all Buddhist activity and of all Buddhahood is the true practice of perceptual truth. The Buddha nature is itself the Buddha, and should you awaken to a complete understanding thereof, your gratitude to the Buddhas will know no bounds. When that guy got it right, he really got it right. You know, an amazing man. Amazing man. And no, I don't believe that a human being could put those words, you know, do full justice to them like Ramanasa did.